Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Notorious Edward Lowe, Pursuing the Last Great Villain of Piracy's Golden Age, by Len Travers. Narrated by Paul Woodson. Prologue. Encounter at Sea. Dawn, June 10th, 1723. 42 nautical miles south of Montauk Point, Long Island. The crew of His Majesty's ship Greyhound was more than usually alert as night slowly gave way to a lightening sky. A ship always had at least part of its crew awake and at work. This day the morning watch had begun, as usual, when 8 strokes of the ship's bell, or 4 o'clock in the morning, as some of the greener hands aboard might still be reckoning it, signaled the end of the middle watch. Aboard this Royal Navy 6th-rate, a modest warship of 20 guns, there were the usual duties: updating the log, pumping the bilges, all ships leaked, cleaning the weather deck. No captain liked having an idle crew. But there was a heightened sense of anticipation among the men. Lookouts at the mastheads had been told to keep particularly good watch, especially forward. Experienced hands knew there were no natural hazards to fear this far out to sea, and an encounter the previous night with a Virginia vessel had occasioned an immediate course change and rumors of pirates in these waters. Greyhound was heading northerly, as if to regain its station at New York. Captain Peter Solgard came on deck. He was an experienced officer, though this was his first command of a naval vessel. He wore no uniform. Army officers and soldiers had adopted red coats decades ago, but the Navy had not mandated uniform clothing, and would not for another quarter century. Solgard had held his commission as captain of the Greyhound for less than a year, and this was his first cruise aboard her. The warship had left New York only 9 days before, after a long winter and spring spent in repairs, refitting, and recruiting. This short tour to the southeast of New York was part patrol, part shakedown cruise. Solgard was seeing for the first time how his crew, the inevitable mixture of old and new hands, was sorting out. So far all seemed to be going well enough. Solgard received the usual report from the officer of the watch as he mounted the steps to the low quarter-deck, but he would have seen and felt for himself the essentials. The ship was on the port tack, the breeze light, maddeningly so, as it had been on and off for days, and from the west-northwest, not Greyhound's best point of sailing. Although it was June, this far away from land there was plenty of chill in the air, which would persist until the sun broke above the horizon. Dark gray gave way to lighter shades tinged with blue, and the circle of visible seascape beyond the ship extended steadily. If, as seemed likely, the day stayed clear, the men in the tops would be able to see other vessels at 20 miles. A half hour or so into the watch, the cry came down. 2 vessels spotted, both sloops, bearing north, on an easterly course only 2 leagues, or 6 miles, distant. Solgard took in the information, but took no immediate action. He had been warned that the notorious pirate, Edward Lowe, who had been on a rampage in the Atlantic and the Caribbean for more than a year, was in the area, and in force commanding 2 well-armed sloops, agile, single-masted vessels, with a combined crew substantially larger than Solgard's. These 2 strangers, confirmed to be just such vessels, could be Lowe and his gang. On the other hand, this was a fairly busy stretch of water, with traffic frequently running between Britain's North Atlantic colonies and the West Indies, or to and from British ports. Happening upon 2 merchant vessels quietly going about their business out here would hardly be unusual. The sloops showed no immediate interest in Greyhound. Perhaps they had not seen her yet. The issue was settled when the lookouts reported both sloops to be coming about, turning to the south on a course to intercept Greyhound. There was little time to consider. On a converging course, the vessels would close the distance within the hour, even in this light breeze. Solgard needed no time to ponder. He had made up his mind long before what to do if he faced a situation like this. He gave the order for all hands to ready about. Puzzled glances may have come his way, but men went to their stations, cast off lines, and readied themselves for the orders to tack ship. When the call, "Helm a lee!" came, the ship began to turn into the wind, and with the practiced sequence of orders, sailors hauled in sails, braced yards, and reset all as the ship came through the eye of the wind and settled on her new southerly course. Out to sea, away from New York, away from the pirate sloops gliding down toward her. His Majesty's warship Greyhound was running away. Or so it seemed. The encounter between Solgard, Low, and their respective crews occurred in the latter years of what some historians have called the Golden Age of Atlantic piracy. A decade-long period of depredation following the end of a long war among the European powers. Economic upheaval, rapid military demobilization, and a scramble for new markets in the post-war world had resulted, among other things, in a flood of piratical activity unlike those that had gone before. Official response to this new assault on trade had been sluggish and ineffectual at first, slowly gaining traction and momentum as governments learned to apply both carrot and stick to the problem. In the meantime, seamen driven by poverty or circumstance seized vessels, organized themselves into crews, elected leaders, and set off on voyages that took them around the rim of the Atlantic Ocean and into the Caribbean Sea, making a crude, dangerous, and usually short-lived career of armed theft. Raiders found clandestine markets for their stolen goods, briefly established a base of operations at Nassau in the Bahamas, and for a time bedeviled all attempts to eradicate them. The story of HMS Greyhound and her encounters with pirates reveals much about this last great wave of Atlantic piracy. Who became pirates and why? How pirates operated and why their reign of terror rapidly declined? This book refutes many hoary myths of this overly glamorized era, focusing on the career of an infamous pirate captain, Edward Low. Low's reputation as the most vicious and sadistic corsair of the age was largely built by rumor, sensationalist newspaper reports, and the lurid imagination of one early chronicler of piracy. That blood-soaked representation has gone virtually unchallenged by historians and popular writers ever since. This story also tells a good deal about the new and vital role played by Britain's American colonies, first in the expansion of piracy before 1700, and then in its suppression. What made some colonists enthusiastic supporters of sea-roving predators in the era of William and Mary, but fervent advocates of their destruction in the reign of George I, 20 years later? Over the last few decades, academic and popular writers, as well as film producers, have portrayed pirates as a floating proletariat, an egalitarian brotherhood, heroic underdogs, and seafaring ninjas, whose mastery of blade, bullet, and cannonball made them fearsome adversaries. The reality was starkly different. Feared they certainly were, but pirates were, for the most part, ordinary seamen, trapped in dire circumstances, with no special martial qualities to recommend them, and ultimately with little to show for their efforts. Contrary to popular perception, this golden age was a time of radically diminishing returns for piracy, little in the way of treasure, buried or otherwise, and of increasingly successful suppression by state authorities. One by one, safe havens were closed to the sea rovers, and their depredations in America quickly squandered the long-held sympathy and support pirates once enjoyed among common folk. We see all of this through the career of the notorious pirate gang captained by Edward Low, and in the story of HMS Greyhound, a British naval vessel with a deadly stain on its honor. Their courses ultimately converged in a furious day-long battle, followed by a dramatic trial and an unprecedented mass execution. Eschewing the rose-tinted glasses worn by authors of popular narratives, instead, I direct the listener's interest to much of what has been minimized or left out of histories of the so-called Golden Age. Previously unpublished primary sources from London's National Archives, and a reconsideration of more familiar texts, for too long taken at face value, will challenge some cherished notions concerning pirates. This volume offers a more realistic examination of the subject, urging listeners to consider a much more honest and thought-provoking narrative than found in swashbuckling fantasy. In addition to a focus on recovering past lives, the notorious Edward Low shows how British Crown authorities used the Royal Navy and new anti-piracy laws to reclaim a measure of authority over North American colonies that attained a worrisome degree of autonomy. To secure their vital trade against seagoing predators, colonists grudgingly accepted Admiralty support. But while the British government may have seen this compliance as a triumph, colonial acquiescence was always limited, and turned out to be transitory. But this is to get ahead of the story. We will need to go back nearly a year before Captain Solgard's apparent flight from the pirate sloops, when Greyhound and Low were unaware of each other's existence, and Greyhound had a different captain, and endured one of the most shameful and one of the least known defeats in Royal Navy history. We must understand the events that brought naval warships to North American waters in the first place, and thousands of men like Low into the dangerous world of lives on the account. Chapter 1. A Squalid Golden Age. We are in a state of war with the pirates. Governor Francis Nicholson of Virginia, June 10, 1700. In the aftermath of the War of the Spanish Succession, 1701-1714, or Queen Anne's War as it was generally known in the Americas, a dramatic decade-long wave of sea robbery, often glamorized as the Golden Age of Piracy, scourged the Atlantic Rim. This period saw the likes of such colorful pirate leaders as Edward Blackbeard Teach, Calico Jack Rackham, and his more famous henchwomen, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, Bartholomew Roberts, Charles Vane, Stede Bonnet, and a host of others. Through newspapers, popular literature, songs, and even plays, these figures achieved a fame that has persisted to this day, romanticized as anti-heroes, egalitarians in a monarchical world, and liberated from the constraints of law and society ashore. Too much has been made of their supposed lives of freedom and adventure, however. The literary immortality bestowed on pirates by generations of historians, novelists, and enthusiasts masks a sordid reality of desperate, homeless, hunted outlaws in constant peril, and trapped in a career they knew to be dead-ended, probably brief, and with few opportunities for escape. If Atlantic piracy ever enjoyed a genuine golden age, two worthier alternatives come to mind. The first began in the Caribbean in the late 1620s, with small-scale raids and hijackings by French outcasts and hunters called buccaneers, from boucans, small fire pits they used for preparing meat in the native manner. Inspired by the buccaneers' limited successes, and driven by greed, politics, and religious animosity, a growing number of European adventurers began prying aggressively into Catholic Spain's closed Caribbean empire. French buccaneers established a base on Tortuga, a small island off the northwest coast of Hispaniola, the island comprising modern Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and began a campaign of more systematically plundering ships and towns. In 1655, English forces seized the island of Jamaica from Spain, defending against Spanish counterattack by inviting some of the region's roughest elements to accept letters of marque. In times of declared war, these documents were official licenses issued by colonial governors authorizing private armed vessels called privateers to prey exclusively on enemy shipping and towns. Such commissions were valid only for a stated duration, and privateer captains had to share the value of all captured or prize vessels and goods with government, shipowners, and crews. But since news of a state of war could take months to reach the West Indies, and since the European powers generally accepted that treaties made in Europe need not always be binding in the Americas, colonial governors could also issue privateering commissions in self-defense if they felt their colonies threatened. In effect, the English governors at Port Royal, Jamaica's capital, created for their island an auxiliary navy of private raiders vested in protecting their home base, whose activities helped bring wealth and development to the port. When the French crown installed governors at Tortuga, they did much the same. Cloaked in legality and provided with reasonably secure havens at which to rest, recruit, rearm, and spend their loot, buccaneers went on a rampage of pillage and destruction. They were pirates in motive, method, and behavior, certainly the Spanish thought of them as such, but with a piece of paper and a wax seal that said otherwise. Privateer leaders such as Christopher Mings, John Davis, Henry Morgan, and Jean-David Nau terrorized the Spanish at sea and on land. Occupying far-flung, inadequately defended settlements and unable to rout the interlopers, Spanish colonists could offer only feeble resistance to an enemy who could strike at any time and seemingly anywhere. The buccaneers' heyday began to fade after 1670. Once vital to establishing and maintaining the tenuous fingerholds of Spain's enemies in the Caribbean, these soldiers of fortune wore out their welcome as the colonies grew more secure. Trade and sugar production, rather than risky privateering ventures, became the keys to wealth and power. With the Treaty of Madrid in 1670, England's open season on Spanish colonial shipping and cities came to an end. In exchange, the Spanish grudgingly recognized England's title to the islands wrested from them. Morgan himself, who had made his name by sacking Portobello and Panama, went establishment in a big way. He returned from London, after a brief arrest, as Sir Henry Morgan, Lieutenant Governor of Jamaica, and dutifully began executing for piracy men he might have called comrades only a decade before. The French employed freebooters in the Caribbean for almost 30 more years, but eventually dispensed with pirate auxiliaries, and for much the same reasons. Colonial governors no longer issued letters of marque to sea rovers in return for protection, and the infamous privateer havens of Port Royal and Tortuga were closed to them. Men who turned to outright piracy did so at their peril. There were fewer and fewer safe havens for them. The age of the buccaneers had brought fame to some, riches to a few, and misery to thousands of their Spanish victims. The depredations of the Red Sea Men, or Indian Ocean Pirates, from the mid-1680s to about 1700, bid to be considered another golden age, bringing about, as they did, a sea change in popular and especially legal attitudes toward pirates that would be tested after 1715. As was the case with buccaneers, matters of politics, trade, religion, and sheer opportunism played their parts. The squeeze put on pirates and ex-privateers by the closing of their Caribbean bases caused some to cast about for other sources of ill-gotten wealth. A new hunting ground materialized half a world away, in the stretches of water between the west coast of India and the entrance to the Red Sea. The Islamic Mughal Empire was at the height of its power, holding sway over most of what is now India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Dutch, French, and English monopolies, the infamous East Indian companies, had muscled into Mughal waters earlier in the century, on the Indian coast establishing trading compounds called factories after their business agent managers, known as factors. A vigorous and very lucrative commerce in textiles, spices, gems, and other exotic goods enriched both Mughal and European investors, merchants, and political elites. A good deal of this trade involved rich convoys to the Red Sea, bound for Islamic commercial centers like Mocha, which annually received thousands of pilgrims traveling to Mecca. These convoys consisted primarily of Asian-built and operated ships, commodious vessels capable of hauling huge cargoes or transporting scores of pilgrims. It is hard to imagine more tempting targets for pirates. Big, slow, predictable, and carrying compact, high-value goods. The Mughal ships had large crews, but most were poorly armed. The region having enjoyed a long period of peace, their captains scarcely expected trouble at sea. But whereas the buccaneers had attacked Spanish cities such as Panama, Cartagena, and Santo Domingo, in the Indian Ocean, the big scores were to be made on the ocean. By the mid-1680s, predatory European seamen had found their way into this new world of opportunity. But it took the onset of a major European war to turn occasional piracies into a crisis of imperial dimensions. The War of the League of Augsburg, King William's War to the English, began in 1688 and lasted 9 years. Born of European politics, the conflict pitted France against a coalition of European states, including England, and quickly assumed worldwide proportions. Vulnerable trading posts and colonies were fair game. The fighting reached from Hudson's Bay to the Caribbean and to the West African coast. Thanks to privateering, piracy usually decreased in wartime, but King William's War introduced new wrinkles, not least the direct involvement of England's North American colonies. Colonial governors granted letters of marque to privateer captains, much as their West Indian counterparts had done 2 decades before. These raiders were expected to range the western North Atlantic, disrupting commerce between France and its possessions in Canada, but everyone knew that far richer prizes than common merchantmen and fishing vessels lay elsewhere. The stage was set for the most outrageously successful series of voyages in pirate history. Soon after the war commenced, Jamaica's Lieutenant Governor Sir William Beeston reported that several vessels had left his island and have found their way into the Red Sea, where they have committed unheard-of piracies, murders, and barbarities. These are now returned with vast wealth to most of the northern plantations in America, where they quietly enjoy their ill-gotten riches, but whether with or without the knowledge of the colonial governments, I do not know. Colonial governments certainly did know. The war was not a year old when a band of New York privateers, having established their bona fides by taking French vessels near Nova Scotia, set off for the Red Sea aboard the Jacob to make their fortunes. Which they did, returning to New York in 1693 with shares of £800 per man in coin, easily eclipsing Henry Morgan's greatest successes. Governor Benjamin Fletcher could have asked uncomfortable questions regarding the origins of the Jacob's loot. The Privateer's Commission specified only French targets as legitimate, and the East India Company's monopoly excluded non-company English vessels from the area. But any curiosity Fletcher may have displayed disappeared when the crew paid him £100 each for a protection pass, and handed over the Jacob for him to sell. Even after paying Fletcher what anyone would recognize to have been a bribe, each crewman went ashore with the equivalent of 38 years' wages. American seamen from the Chesapeake to Narragansett Bay soon got into the act. Maryland's governor, Francis Nicholson, reported that, "As to privateers and pirates, they come from the Red Sea to New England, New York, and Pennsylvania. Last year about 60 persons came and shared 1,000 to 1,500 pounds a man. They come first to Providence and the Bahama Islands and to South Carolina, where they leave or dispose of their ships, and from thence disperse into these parts in small vessels. Sometimes they come directly to Pennsylvania, New York, and New England, and from these places fit out again to the Red Sea." More worrisome for the war effort, Nicholson continued, "their sharing of such large sums tempts the people of these parts to go along with them, and they are a great hindrance to trade, for the seamen run from the merchant ships to go with them, as do also many of the men from the king's ships." As more commissioned vessels set off for the Indian Ocean to attack the French, and some actually did pay attention to the spirit of their commissions, colonial merchants saw an opportunity to make even more money by supplying privateer pirates in the region where they were marauding. Madagascar was a convenient, relatively safe place for freebooters to clean and repair vessels, rest crews, and divide spoils. Being far from home, they were willing to pay for the rum, food, clothing, tools, and munitions that merchants could supply, at greatly inflated prices, from trading posts on the island. Those same merchants, or more likely their agents, were ideally positioned to purchase slaves for the American market at prices much lower than on Africa's west coast. As one historian put it, "English subjects, often bearing commissions granted them by crown-appointed governors, wrought havoc in one area of English trade, the Indies, to the direct benefit of another, the Atlantic colonies." And so American colonists became drawn into, in fact, embraced, this vigorous new phase of piracy. Beneficiaries ranged from governors to merchants to sailors, and to the many tavern keepers, tradesmen, retailers, and prostitutes who ended up with most of the pirates' money. As long as the war continued, and the privateers could operate with lawful commissions and plausible deniability as to their target's exact nature, it paid not to ask too many questions. As Governor Fletcher himself expressed it, "The treasure these men brought into the cash-starved colonies was a net benefit that enriched the charter governments." Certainly that treasure enriched Governor Fletcher. And the Jacob's success was no one-off. Thomas Tew, a respectable captain from Rhode Island, used the legal gloss provided by his privateer commissions to make two voyages to the Indian Ocean. On the first, in 1693, Tew's sloop, Amity, took a much larger Mughal vessel and plundered that prize of an estimated 100,000 pounds in gold and silver. Adam Baldridge, a New York trader on Madagascar, recorded that Tew's 60-man crew had taken a ship in the Red Sea that did belong to the Moors, as the men did report. They took as much money in her as made the whole share run 1,200 pounds sterling a man. Truly a spectacular haul. Upon the Amity's return to New York, Tew spent a suspiciously good deal of time socializing with Governor Fletcher. Fletcher even admitted that he and Tew exchanged gifts before Tew left on what would be his last, and for him fatal, voyage to the Red Sea. Other seamen came back to the Atlantic world with unusual wealth, but of all the Red Seamen, the most successful, infamous, and consequential for our story was Henry Avery. Unlike the more circumspect Tew, Avery made no pretenses of legality. He and his crew were out-and-out pirates. In May 1694, they had mutinied and seized their English privateering ship Charles II on the west coast of Africa, renaming her Fancy. They sailed into the Indian Ocean in early 1695, pausing at Madagascar for provisions. Setting out toward the Red Sea, Avery joined a squadron of
sample complete. Ready to continue?